average for regular is
$4.70. Log Talk Radio.
You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
Thanks, everyone, for baking your way here on this toasty morning. Are you all ready to jam? Excellent. Before we get rolling, let's start by hashing out everything bagel we'll be discussing. Profit margins are okay, but they could maybe be butter. Sorry, I don't mean to waffle. Next quarter, it's all or muffin. Did you have a question, Sausage Patty?
My name's Patricia.
When you can't take your mind off breakfast, it matters where you stay. Delicious breakfast available at our Hilton family of brands. Hilton, for the stay.
And now for your alternative talk weather outlook. For today, we'll have scattered showers throughout the day under mostly cloudy skies, giving us a high near 72 and southwest winds around 6 miles per hour. Overnight, those conditions continue with a low around 59. For tomorrow, we'll see gradually clearing skies throughout the day, bringing us a high near 73 and a low around 57. And finally for Friday, partly sunny, high near 73.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Basile and Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Aubert, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers us with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
We are so excited here at Transformation Change Radio, Dr. Becky Martinez, I'm Dr. Kathy Aubert. I don't know if this is number 7 or 8, but each one we've gone deeper, broader, after 3 years of working at dismantling racism and whiteness, to really be here focusing now on classism, what it is, dismantling it. We could not be more excited. Evangeline Weiss, here from Beyond Conflict. We are so excited you're here. We both have known you for years in different ways, and yet we were both saying that we haven't seen you for a while, so can't wait to see who you are now. And as I looked at your bio, because I knew you from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which we used to call it that, and now I think it's just called Task Force often. You had with Reverend Dr. Jamie Washington and his group had us come in and do some anti-racism work. And that's one way I knew you, through the Social Justice Training Institute. I believe you're an alum and had a whole bunch of people from the task force come. What I didn't know is how much, and I love this, social change designer. I just love that frame, community building, organizational development, your decades of that work. I didn't know you were at Duke University, or I forgot, doing equity inclusion work out of the center there for Office of Institutional Equity. Then leadership program director at the task force for years, really helping that organization partner with others to be truly equitable in the full breadth of differences, but particularly racial justice. So I have to say, I couldn't be more excited. The line you have in your bio, I love sustaining leaders on a path, purpose, and impact. I have a feeling that's something the three of us and many of the listeners share. And so to have you here, thank you so much. To talk about dynamics of class and classism, which Becky and I believe have far too little attention over the centuries, much less today.
Yeah, so I'm excited to have you here. As we were brainstorming folks, you came to mind as I think about your work around social justice at the high level. But also around race and racism, especially as we worked together for years. And, like, we got to play and we got to learn and we were challenged in many ways that I'm glad that we've passed through those moments. And growing, creating change from, like, 300 people to over 1,000 people in some years. And then just learning more about your story. Both through a race lens, but also through a gender lens and a sexuality lens and a class lens. So I'm excited, as you said before we got on. Oh, like I'm not, like I saw you feeling your chest, right, and the anxiousness that can come, and the joy that can come, and excitement from this thing that we call class, and are part of it every day, and it's part of us, and yet we don't name it. Yeah, and so I know you enough to know how your body's like, whoo. Even that.
Yes.
So I want to start out by, we want to, again, thank you. And as we start out, almost every interview or every conversation is tell us a little bit about your class story.
Thank you. It is so great to be here. It's wonderful to see you both. And I love this question. It's become really a center, thinking about class has become a more centered question in the last few years for me as I do racial justice work with white people. And my class story is probably not that unusual. I grew up in Westchester County, north of New York City, upper middle class family, Jewish, progressive family that really saw their activism as writing checks to the NAACP and the ACLU. So very like philanthropy minded in terms of a class analysis, but very distanced. And we used to drive into the city to my aunt's apartment in the West Village and have that experience of like driving through the Bronx and my mom being like, okay, girls, make sure your doors are locked. And that experience of like not really understanding that like, okay, now we're moving through black and brown space and somehow I can pick up on my mom's anxiety. So like some early messages about us being different, but also or the spaces that we moved through were different places around safety, around who we should be concerned about, but also really recognizing that my parents cared about people who were of a different class, poor people, working class people, but that care was expressed really at a distance. And I'm 55, so Richard Nixon got elected when I was a little kid, and my parents decided that they wanted to leave the country. They had a lot of wealth. They had each inherited a lot of wealth, and they ran a travel agency in Westchester. And when Nixon got elected, my parents decided to move to the south of France. So for 10 years, I lived in a Roman like walled village in the south of France where there were no cars and it was cobblestones and centuries old buildings. We moved there with my grandmother and I grew up speaking French and my sister and I would run around in Valbonne and we were like les Américaines, you know, the little American girls. And really my understanding of class there kind of as a child, I have language now to describe it. As a child, I don't think I had any kind of analysis. I just knew that we moved in spaces that were very fancy, where I had to wear fancy clothes and I had to learn, like, there were lots of forks and lots of knives and there was a lot going on the table. And then I also moved through spaces that were, you know, running through bamboo forests and holy pants and, you know, being kind of a wild child. And didn't have much of an analysis of like the private school that I went to or the things about that experience that were different. Meanwhile, in grown-up land, my father lost his job and my parents struggled to stay in France. And so when I was 13 years old, we moved back to the United States. And that's when I went from, I think, being an upper middle class person to just a middle class person. Both of my parents worked. My mother did not work in France. She was taking care of her mother, my grandmother, who lived with us. And when we moved back to the United States, we moved to Westchester County. And I went to public high school there. And I don't remember much about that in terms of having an analysis other than my parents talking a lot about credit cards and money and budgeting. And I remember like lots of tension around like trips to the mall and like what could we afford? How many pairs of pants could we afford? So things have changed. But I think looking back, I have a greater understanding of that. At the time, it was very mysterious. And then obviously fast forward, getting educated, going off to college. My parents took out a loan and I took out a loan to go to undergraduate. And I went to a super fancy liberal arts college that I loved and that loved me and really got to meet people who were way wealthier than me, as well as people who had grown up with much less than me. And so I think it was in college that I started to really understand both, like, the experience of class, but also begin to have, like, what is Marxism? What is socialism? How do capitalism and democracy work together? How do they not work together? And so intellectually and academically started to learn more. And then, again, keeping fast forwarding, getting my first jobs as a professional person in New York City working on HIV and AIDS, at both the New York City Department of Health and then Gay Men's Health Crisis, a lot of that early professional work that I did in human services was just a really deep dive into class dynamics. Mm-hmm. I mean, race was in it, sexuality was in it, but, you know, I was doing a training through the Department of Health for people who wanted to get third-party reimbursed for pre- and post-HIV test counseling. And so we were training 911 operators and social workers and nurses and doctors and psychiatrists and the people who worked on the AIDS hotline. And it became really clear to me that the horror of the AIDS epidemic so completely manifesting through a society that cares more about profit than cares about people. And so the homophobia, the racism, the classism, that just felt like people were disposable. And so when we sit in this moment now in the pandemic with COVID, I've been reliving a lot of my experiences with HIV in the 90s in New York. I've started now. I'm just going to end. I don't know how much I want to keep going, but like the place I've landed now in doing white people work, a lot of white people work in my racial justice work is really helping white people to understand how much our understanding of whiteness and race is about our class experience. Like, I know that my white person experience is really different than so many other white people's experience. I mean, I had a foreign country. I had parents who valued being multilingual. I went to a private liberal arts college. Like, I was not crippled with debt when I got out. Like, there's just so much about being white that is particular to my story and other upper middle class and middle class people. And I know there are working class and poor white people who came into their whiteness through a really different stories and really different experiences. And I want white people to understand that we have to claim our class story in order to be better allies and in order to be more effective in racial justice space. So I've been doing a lot more of that work in the last 5 years, and I'm sure we'll get into it. We'll talk more about it. But that's a little bit of what I can remember of my class story right now.
Oh, my gosh. We could do episodes and episodes. I want to be like, oh, so talk to me about this and talk to me about that. And I guess we will save some of that for another time and then some of that for now. I'm curious to know and you talked a little bit about your, like the messages you received, some of those, how do other messages and those still show up today in you and how you navigate, how you do work, how you parent, how you partner, how you be? I'm curious.
Yeah. I mean, I am so much more aware today of the particularity of how money impacts all of us, all of our decisions. Like, as I was thinking about getting on having this conversation with the two of you, one of the things that comes up for me is ease.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have so much ease. I have oodles and oodles of these in terms of food, in terms of leaving my house, not leaving my house, how I navigate the world, where I go, how I gift, when I gift, how I define my work, how I think about my worth. So how I define my work and how I think about my worth. All of those things are so impacted by my money story today. So I'm trying to think about, like, being concrete. I had a birthday party recently, and I haven't seen my friends in 2 years. Like, we've been my wife is immune compromised, and I've been hyper vigilant about COVID and really have been a shut-in. Like, Zoom has been my life. And I decided, you know, worked with her around precautions and how we could do it. and we invited about 15 of my friends to come hang out in the backyard. This is a couple weeks ago. And I have friends who are span all kinds of diversity, race, gender, sexuality, class. And I wanted to have a meaningful conversation at my birthday party. I didn't want to just get together and drink and eat. And I don't know if it's the facilitator in me or if I was just hungry for, like, getting this beautiful group of people together and wanting to do something more meaningful. Maybe it's because we're living in, like, dumpster fire times. And so I came up with this idea, and I want to walk it through with you because I think it's totally it's such a great story for, like, my money, like my inner dialogue around money. I decided that I'm turning 55, and I just woke up one day, and I literally was like, I want to give everybody at the party $55, and I want us to have a conversation about what we care about and where we think our money can make a difference. And so, like, I facilitated this thing. I called it Game 55. And I went through this whole manifestation in my head of, like, I didn't want people who didn't have $55 to feel pressure. So I was like, the only way to do this is to just fund it. So I'm going to put the money on the table. And then anybody that wants to match me or meet me is welcome to put their own $55 on the table. But I wanted us to start from, like, I wanted to remove the anxiety for people who might not want to play. And we broke up into small groups, and we did three rounds, and people talked about what was important to them and where they felt like money could make a difference in their communities. And then we came back together, and we shared. Then we went back into small groups and tried to, like, come up with some consensus. And at the end of the, like, 45 minutes or whatever it was, we decided that we were going to split the money between a Black organizer who lives here in North Carolina who's struggling and has to move from one place, has an unstable living situation and needs to move, and that the other half of the money was going to go to a mutual aid group here in Greensboro. And I did not do an evaluation. I didn't send an evaluation out to my friends. But, like, it was I was so hung up in my head about, like, what it was going to feel like to ask for this from my friends. And these are people who love me. They know me. They know my heart. And I still felt like this was a big deal to ask people to talk about money and where they would put it. And I did provoke the group to say, like, if it was your $55, you know, like, how much is this different because it's someone else's money that we're talking about? And I don't know, I'm not sure this is kind of getting at your question, but it's like, I'm very aware, you know, 15 times 55, like, that's what I wanted to do, to have this experience with my friends. And I don't know, I mean, about half the group matched us. And I know that the organizer, the Black woman organizer who received her half of the money, you know, was incredibly grateful for that. But I, you know, she was like, what do I say? What do I do? And I was like, totally okay. You don't need to stay or do anything. This is, like, to make your life, to give you more ease in your life. Yeah. Like, I want to transfer ease from my community to your community. And I think I'll just pause there as, like, an example. I know my wife and my son were like, what are we doing? Why aren't we just going to, like, light a cake with some candles? Like, what is this?
Yeah. First of all, that sounds very you, and happy belated birthday. Because I'd be like, where's the cake? Well, and that story has so much more than just money involved, right? More than financial capital, which is where we often talk about class. But it is the social capital and the cultural capital. So, like, the layers of capital and the thinking and the feeling about it. And what now I'm going to take with me and use, because I don't think we've heard the word, and I haven't in the work that I do, even around class and classism, is ease. Like, that has captured me, because we often talk about it as privilege and access. Ease just makes it feel even more, I don't even have a word for it. Navigating these different arenas of our lives and our bodies with ease. That almost has me like I don't have any words for it. The way that it lands.
Yeah.
less stress, less illness, less physical impact, just to have peace and ease. I know I've been wanting that in my life. I hadn't quite connected the dots. So thank you, Evangeline, of how much of that is because of my class privilege, race privilege, and I could keep going. Our listeners might need a breath.
Yes.
Your story is fabulous on so many levels, the life as well as this birthday one, and the ease with which you talk about class, even though I don't know what's going on inside, seems different from people that I'm with, hang out with. And so what got my attention was people are expendable. And the connection from HIV, AIDS, I don't know if we call that a pandemic, to now, but this expendable. So if I'm thinking inside organizations where I have a lot of energy and wanting leaders and managers to really see classism, just wondering, how do you see classism playing out in organizations? You work with nonprofits, you work with international, I mean, you work with corporate, you work wherever you work, but how do you see it playing out eventually by the end after a break in a bit? We'd love to hear some strategies that you've seen or you're doing beyond just the what is classism in organizations as subtle and insidious as well as the blatant. And then always we're looking for what's possible or what do you see? But let's start with what have you seen?
Well, there's definitely a way in which white supremacy culture and classism are so intricately woven together. You know, oftentimes, I know you probably do this as well, but when we unpack professionalism, it's so laden with expectations that are based in middle class and upper middle class values, things that people learn in graduate school, the presumptions. And I think that just kind of flows through nonprofits of like what it means to be a good organization, what it means to be a right organization, a deserving organization. So from the HR perspective, like so many of our standards around communication, around professionalism feel to me embedded in classism. And I think it's really challenging to kind of put the mirror up to an organization and say like, well, what would it be like if it was totally okay for people to use emojis in their emails? Or what would it be like if you get the gist of the sentence and the grammar isn't correct or there's a spelling error, like you understand what the person was trying to say. So like, is that really problematic? I mean, if you don't understand what the message is, then yes, you need to go back and maybe outward facing versus inward facing, but like really diving into some of the ways that judgment just exists. And we rationalize that judgment by using terms like professionalism. The other place that I see classism just all over the place is in fundraising. Mm-hmm. And organizations and this is true for universities, nonprofits, like the way in which fundraising and philanthropy really focuses on like major donors and like networking with rich people. And what I think organizations forget is that who funds you is who owns you. And if the people that you're accountable to that own you are rich people, your major donors, and the institutional givers that are supporting you, then how are you accountable to the poor people? How are you accountable to stakeholders who are not major donors? And when I work with organizations and I try to help them develop a stellar grassroots fundraising strategy, there is so much class work that has to happen for people to believe in it. I mean, even when Obama ran for president and did, you know, the $5, $20 gift and political fundraising changed so much, that there was so much energy in the country around that, right, that he could see all these stakeholders representing a broader class spectrum. And so I've really been working to like help organizations recognize the classism embedded in their fundraising.
And what are some of those strategies, right? And so like, what are some of the ways in which you have organizations engage in class differently or maybe it's not even engaged, like recognize, like, yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I mean, getting a board together or a staff together to tell their money story. So the money story activity, and having people recognize their relationship to money and some of the assumptions that they're making about who has money and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure you know that when you look at the research, working class and poor people, if you look at what they're giving in terms of if you broaden giving out beyond money, there's way more generosity. So it's a really interesting moment to confront as an organization that you're basically saying there's this whole subset of stakeholders that you're going to turn your back on. And people, of course, don't want to do that. They want to see themselves as serving their whole community. So then really strategizing was like, well, what would it feel like to have a $5 campaign? And what if you had 2,000 people join your $5 campaign? And how much effort would that take? And then you have 2,000 people on your list, 2,000 more people who care about your mission, who know what you're up to. So I think it requires some training. And then I think it also goes with the story of, like, people who want to diversify their board, right? Mm. So that's kind of how I backed into this conversation, was that I had a lot of conversations with white board members who were like, well, we want to diversify the board, but we need people to be able to make the give get. And then I would say, okay, well, do you really?
Yeah.
And, like, how can we talk about what it means to bring up, like, what is the value of this perspective? And they may not be able to make a $5,000 gift, but they can open up a world of education and experience and perspective to this board that no one else here can do. So how do you put a price tag on that?
Yeah, that is a great suggestion. And I'm going to incorporate some of those suggestions. We're going to go on break. And we would love to know how folks can get a hold of you, can contact you to connect and collaborate.
Oh, great. My company is called Beyond Conflict, and my email address is evangeline@gobeyondconflict, and the URL is www.gobeyondconflict.com.
Wonderful. There are so many things that we can talk about. And so I want to think about what's an important nugget of information that you would like to continue to talk about, or piece of your story, as you've now had a little bit of time to take some deep breaths and reflect and talk and think about, so how does classism still show up in my work, in me, and outside of my work? Thank you so much. Yeah. For this conversation thus far.
So much. Good stuff.
Stay tuned. Transformation Change Radio. We'll be right back.
You're driven, and it totally shows. Your career is taking off. You're killing it in the mom game. But did your health needs make it on the plate this week? Tune in to Boss Up Babes, where Carissa Adkins helps babes show up, boss up, and thrive. Every second and fourth Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Become the boss babe you were meant to be. To sign up for one of Carissa's group coaching programs, visit 365DailyHustle.com.
Wonderful. Welcome back. We are still in this deep conversation with Evangeline. And during break, we had so many possibilities to talk about. And I think one of the gifts that Evangeline has is to be able to share story with then strategy, right? Even though it may feel heavy, right, and feel challenging, I think that is a gift you have. So let's continue this conversation as we think about that learning through a lens of class and it being individually experienced and how we can shift organizations.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've been thinking about how so much of organizational culture wants to silence a conversation about money. Mm-hmm. And there are actually organizations where in their personnel manuals, it's forbidden for people to share how much they make and for them to talk about their salary. And it's something that I've encountered. I've been in a many of the organizations I've worked in have been union shops. So the labor movement is a place where this conversation is happening. The conversations about money, compensation, class are alive. But as we know, unions are also really struggling because there's a lot of momentum and organizing to shut them down. I worked at an organization for a while where we had a labor union and we were trying to, it was when COVID started, we were trying to figure out if there was going to need to be layoffs and how to make decisions about what we were going to do as an organization because of the pandemic and the stress on the organization. And the union members came up with a plan that if all of the employees in the organization took the same salary for 2 years, we wouldn't have to lay anybody off.
Wow.
We like did the math.
That went over really well, didn't it?
Yeah, it was so painful. It was so painful. And the organization chose the layoffs, right? Chose for the people who were earning more to maintain their wealth, maintain their income, and to ask people to leave. And the people who were asked to leave were overwhelmingly lower paid people. There were one or two people in manager roles who'd left, but five or six people at lower levels left. And in the lead up to this, I will never forget the meeting where we were going to talk about how much we made, and we had never shared that information with each other. And we created a spreadsheet and we put everybody's name on the spreadsheet and we invited people to claim what their salary was.
Wow.
And it was incredibly powerful and anxiety producing. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of feelings about it, and we had some really hard conversations about it. And it was terrifying for me. I had a feeling that I was one of the highest paid people in the union, and my fears were confirmed. Mm-hmm. And so as a white person, as an older person, as a cis person, as a person who grew up upper middle class, I was loaded up with shame. And I think there's so much work to be done. We have to do our own work to be able to have these hard conversations. On the one hand, I had nothing to be ashamed of. Like, I advocated for my salary. I was working. I was in that system. I was doing hard work. I think my salary was fair. And I was embarrassed and scared of how my colleagues were going to perceive me, who were making less than me. So I think that one of the strategies that organizations can use is to be courageous and to have really open and honest conversations about salary. And I think that's revolutionary in nonprofit culture. And I guess my question for boards and for leadership teams is, what is threatening about it? Right, because we all know that on the 990 forms, you know, the tax forms, the top earners in the organization get named. Mm-hmm. So somehow, if you think about that through a class analysis, the people who make the most, we're going to name who they are.
Yeah.
Right? But then what about the rest of the organization, the people who are making less? What suddenly changes? And are we just reinforcing this idea that if you earn less, that you're not as worthy? And like, what does it mean to set some bands? What does it mean to say no one that works here is going to earn less than this amount, right? If you're embarrassed as an organization to state how much someone earns, then maybe you should be looking at like what you're paying people. So I think that's a very courageous strategy, and I know organizations are doing that work and having like the revolution around posting job openings and saying what the salary band is for the job opening. And there's been so much advocacy on the part of poor people and working class people to say, I'm not applying for the job if I don't know. Like, I think that's an example of advocacy that the margin has done to say to the mainstream, hey, you better accommodate us and tell us what's going on here. So I definitely wanted to mention that. And, you know, another story that comes to mind, maybe I should take a breath. Should I take a breath?
Do you feel like you need to take a breath?
No, I feel like I could roll.
Okay, well then roll.
Okay, so this other story that comes to mind is when I was working on leadership development, and I was responsible for planning retreats. A lot of the work that I did was with people in retreat settings. And we did a retreat for some leaders at a retreat center that was very rustic in nature, out in the middle, you know, an hour and a half from a major metropolitan place, an hour and a half from the airport. And people were staying in cabins, and it was really nice, but it was like in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And the first night, people put their stuff away, and then we're all going to come to dinner, and I'm in the dining room, like, working with the cooks to make sure the food's on time. And this woman of color, working class woman of color, comes into the dining hall and walks right up to me, and she says, "I think I need to go back to the airport." And I was just so concerned, and I was like, "Please, tell me what's going on." And she said, "I've never slept any place that doesn't have a lock on the door. And I don't think I can stay here." And it was like this boom moment for me, right? That, like, never, like, I was comfortable in the space. Mm-hmm. Me, my middle-class, upper-middle-class body, my body was comfortable in that space. And it didn't occur to me to, like, pan for class. It didn't occur to me to, like, think about what's it going to be like to be a working-class person who's lived in a with a lock on their door in different kinds of spaces, right, rural or urban.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to really work with her, and it turned out that in the main house where the dining room was and where the kitchen was, there was a room that had a lock on the door. And so we helped her move her stuff over there, and we accommodated her. But, boy, did that changed my checklist. That changed my checklist for space, and it was a real awareness of, like, the ways in which I am loaded up with that ease, mm-hmm. to the point where I'm not thinking about what is it like for people who have less ease, and what are some of the needs and the comfort and the safety concerns that people might have that I'm not tracking. And mm-hmm. that's because of my class. Like, I was on my journey learning, and now I know. Now I know a little bit more, mm-hmm. right?
Wow. As I hear that, because, and I think it is the class and race.
Gender.
Gender, and not paying attention. And that is, you've been with us at the Social Justice Training Institute, and that's one of the reasons that panning for us is so critical, right, to be able to pay attention and to think, like, oh, what may I be missing? And then as I hear your story, it is sometimes in our places of ease, we learn at the expense of.
Right, exactly.
And how do we, like, engage that in our organizations? Like, how do we talk about those moments, those hard, difficult, courageous moments? And the salary moments, which are courageous, particularly because we're socialized and we learn not to talk about money in direct ways. Like, the salaries are posted. Like, you can find them. You may have to do some digging. And some people are like, that's why I don't want to work at a public. That's why I want to work at a private. That's why I want to work in this type of industry.
We make
so that people may not know. And it's usually the people who are earning higher salaries that don't want to know. Right? Like, you know, it's those. I'd like it to be more. But in those higher salaried ranges, the discomfort that we have, even as you said, even given all of your work, right, and your dedication, there was still anxiety and unease about people knowing.
Yeah.
And how the shame and guilt can be a part of that.
Yeah. So, new insight, Becky, shame and guilt and arrogance entitlement. Because if I'm talking at the group level, not about you, Angela, but if folks upper middle class, more wealthy, only had shame and guilt, then we would change our individual and collective behavior and have resources, realize that actually these resources, they're given to me from a classless situation. And I worked hard, but so does someone who literally was outside going through the dog park and cleaning it up this morning. And actually that was harder work than I'll do probably the entire week I'll put together. The other thing that got me with your story, and there's so many, but one was that, and I relate to this, I made decisions for other people. So I've planned leadership retreats, and to even ask that question for folks listening, to say it again, of having everybody say, this is the places we're thinking of going. What could be some comfort, safety, needs that we're not thinking about? It's just a, it's just good planning, much less it's with a class lens, and in this case, race, gender, and others. The other thing it ties for me is, and you said it early, you said, I know my worth. When I hear that from my class growing up, my worth is how much money I make. And so I wonder how much this ties back to folks who are making six figures and above, because I don't know if that's the cutoff, 80,000 and above, depending maybe where you live. They're like, oh, no, I worked hard. I earned this. I deserve it. You make it public, then people will question if I really earned it or I'm worth it. So how much of our class self-work and our privileged identity is self-esteem, who we are, regardless of how much money society says they're going to give us? Those are some random thoughts.
Yes. It's the silence around money is really deafening. It's really painful. And I think there's so much benefit that organizations can have, being honest about the budget, being transparent about budgets, being transparent about salaries, helping all of the employees, not just the leadership team, understand what it means to create the budget, what it means to make decisions. And I think that's a place where organizations have opportunity to get more investment, more buy-in from program staff, more buy-in from operations staff, if we know, you know, here's what we're working with. And it was so heartbreaking to watch an to really want to have that conversation and be ready for it and engage with it and just recognize that there was so much fear. And, you know, I think that even it's like my birthday party example, it's like I'm trying to build this muscle of becoming more comfortable talking about money in my personal life so that I can be more comfortable talking about money with my clients, so I can be more comfortable talking about money as a coach working with people. And I think there's so many opportunities. So you may not want to start, you know, negotiating with your boss or forming a union, or like there's higher stakes places to agitate. You may want to just start with having conversations with your kids or your neighbors. If you have a tree that needs to get cut down and one neighbor has more resource than the other neighbor, like, do we have to split it 50-50? Maybe that doesn't make sense. Maybe one neighbor has more money to put towards cutting the tree down. Like, I'm just using that as a silly example. But there's like so many assumptions that we have in our day-to-day life about what it means to be fair and to share the responsibility. Mm-hmm. And we avoid the conversation about what people are bringing to the table because it's embarrassing to get into the details of like, well, I could bring more to the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious to know, what are other ways that classism shows up in organizations that aren't directly tied to money, right? And so you talked a little bit about professionalism, right, and how that may not be that doesn't necessarily have to center around money if we have knowledge around, if we have networks and connections around how to show up professional, right? I'm curious how you see classism exist beyond money or in addition to money as you navigate and as members navigate being part of organizations.
Yeah, thank you. I think that there's some things coming up for me around the different roles that people play and the different assumptions we have about role. And I think that classism can express itself around expectations, like how clean the break room is, or who's responsible for tidying up. Yeah. And I think we've all seen examples of like, oftentimes the lowest paid person in the organization is the person who's in the break room cleaning the microwave. I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think that's an accident. And I would also venture to say that 9 out of 10 times it's probably not in your job description. Right? So it's like there's this presumption of like who's going to stay behind and clean up, who's going to be there early to set up. And that is so often determined by how much status you have in the organization, what your positional power is, which, you know, extrapolating back down, like, is more often going to be a white person, more often going to be a person who has a graduate degree, not exclusively, but oftentimes the person with the most status is not the person staying behind to clean up after the meeting.
Yeah.
Other examples around dress, around language, boundaries. I think that there's this interesting way in which people don't, my experience as an upper middle class person is that there are times when I feel like it can go either way, but it's like I experience people oversharing because they don't care what people think. They don't have to care what people think.
Mm.
Or I experience people pulling back and not sharing at all because they're scared, ashamed, don't know how to do it right. And so I think there's ways in which I think maybe that's elitism or maybe it's classism, not really sure what the difference is sometimes.
Mm.
But those group dynamics where just how do you relax, right? Who's better at just relaxing?
Mm.
And maybe that's a numbers game, right, of like the majority of the group is working class, so it feels like a more working class vibe, or the majority of the group is upper middle class and they're setting the tone, they're determining the vibe, and oftentimes doing it without any kind of self-referential, no understanding of what's happening. Like the vibe is created, and then what are we going to do about that? Who's benefiting from this vibe? So in these casual moments, food. Oh my God, food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we going to eat? Where are we going to go to eat? Class shows up in a minute in that conversation. How do we split the checks and all that good stuff?
Yeah.
So I think those experiences affect a person at work. They affect a person being able to feel like they fit in, being able to feel like they can participate in the full life of the organization. And I think that, again, circling back to do your work, if you're leading or you have positional power in these environments and you don't have a class analysis, you might attribute these dynamics to like personality, individual personality, as opposed to the systems that are operating for people, the group identities that are operating for people.
I just flashed the last place. I'm sorry, Becky. No, go ahead. Place I worked inside, never occurred to me invite the administrative assistant out to social hour. Invited peers who were the leadership team as well as graduate students because we were in a residence hall. Never occurred to me. And then how many times in meetings are folks in different roles, status roles, invited to meetings, even the word invited, are they a regular part of meetings with two and three layers of quote managers, but not asked to take the notes? They're there to provide insight because they're the implementers of decisions. So can they be involved in decisions and not just told about them?
Mm-hmm.
So many ways.
So many ways. And I thank you for the, some people would name them small examples. And yet they're not. Like they're such big examples and so blatant. And I think one of the nuances also is what folks, so people may have positional titles and may have particular salaries that are six figures plus, or as Kathy says, that 80,000, whatever may be higher for your area of living. But what I often find is the nuance of your class of origin too.
Mm.
And so there could be like the VP, you know, who earns title and the money and that is in the room and that gets the authority and is looked for the knowledge, also could be the one at the end cleaning up the coffee, right? Like cleaning up the coffee mug that people just left there. And then some people notice that, like, well, why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there is this like tug around can I and should I, and there would be no other option. Like, you all aren't cleaning up after yourself, so of course I'm going to do that because that is what I knew and what I see. And how do we really in organizations talk about those dynamics? not just the dynamic of the current class, but that class of origin that may find that tug, and of the expectations or of the language or of the dress, because it is, it's like complex and it's messy and it's delightful.
As you were talking, Becky, I flashed, it was probably going to be folk of color or white women who stayed after. And the cost to them for their other colleagues who were not, then judging. So the thought of, can you imagine if senior leader said, we're going to stay an extra 5-10 minutes, planted in your schedule. We're going to be cleaning up, all of us. And if people want to stay after and talk with us, then we're accessible as well. Maybe make it 15 minutes. So these small shifts and changes can tell very big messages of, but only if that's not performative in a checkbox, that some of these other more strategic, how we do hiring, onboarding, salary negotiation that some other folks have talked about on the radio show. We just have a few minutes left. Angela, is anything you haven't said, any story that you, in a couple minutes, that what you're working on or what you've been thinking and musing about or just anything else that you want to leave listeners with?
Yeah, thank you. In Finding Freedom, which is a workshop for white women and genderqueer people, we really have centered class as a main conversation in doing our work. And I think that it's been a really powerful experience for me to have class-alike breakout rooms during the workshops, having people identify the assumptions and some of the myths and some of the hurts that exist for people, and doing some really courageous work, asking poor and working class people what they need from the group, helping upper middle class and middle class people recognize how easy it is for us to take up space and make assumptions about what is right. And I think that carrying that over into organizations, really, it does take courage, because if we want to lift up the needs and the perspectives of poor and working class people, then that presumes that we can talk about who grew up poor and working class and understand that, similar to racial justice work, we want to, we don't want to put the burden on those folks to like tell us what to do. And we also need to understand more how class is operating. And having those facilitated conversations and bringing those voices in and recognizing the gift that comes from having the perspective of a person who's grew up with a different class background, that has just been really meaningful to me. And being called in on my class background and how that's operating, being in a community where we can have real talk about that. So I really encourage listeners, I encourage all of us to find places where we can talk about not only our current class background, but like you're saying, Becky, talk about how we were impacted by our growing up and the messages that we got.
That sounds like a lovely series. And being able to just be with each other in the space of class, we don't often get those opportunities to reflect and to learn and to be in relation. For me, it's how are we in relationship with each other and class?
Yeah.
That is delightful.
And in those conversations, I wonder if there's a parallel with white privilege, because the guilt and shame that I know as a white person I've experienced, today I can talk about white privilege and access as grifters, and then I'm motivated to use white privilege in community to dismantle racism. I wonder if we will get there with middle, particularly upper middle and even more rich folk, to be able to tell experience and not as my money, but I have it because of classism. And so how can I use class privilege? How can I use resources in ways transparently, collectively? Can you imagine?
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you so much for your wisdom and your sharing and your connection and your teaching. All of those pieces so critical for us to engage in. We'd like you to, again, maybe close us out by like one nugget that you would have and then how folks can connect with you.
Well, people can connect with me through www.gobeyondconflict.com. And a nugget I have is that speaking as an upper middle class person, a person who was raised upper middle class, the silence for me created more anxiety than the conversations. And what I have discovered through the conversations is that my anxiety level around being in multi-class situations, my anxiety has gone down. So I think it's a little, like I've been thinking about the parallel to Resmaa Menakem's dirty pain, clean pain, like the dirty pain of not talking about money versus the clean pain of like doing the hard work of talking about it. And I just really, specifically to people who are listening who grew up upper middle class and haven't found a place to talk about it, that it's a really instrumental way to get in your journey, to do your personal work, so that you can feel less anxiety around being in spaces that have people from lots of different class backgrounds.
Thank you.
It's been so great reconnecting. I so appreciate it.
Yes, us too. This was a gift. So thank you for investing to create change. That is really important for us in this work. Thank you, listeners, for being a part of this. Again, between now and the next one, pay attention to class. Think about how it shows up. Think about your story and the ways that, in the small ways that may be big ways, in the ways it shows up in your life. Thank you so much. Transformational Change. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy Obair on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change. Motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyobair.com. That's drkathyobair.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
As we take a break between these 2 hours of Transformation Talk Radio, I'm Nate here in Alternative Talk 1150 for an 11 AM traffic update. And right now, 405 is seeing some slight hesitation going north through the Renton S-curves, but that lightens up as you work your way over towards Newcastle. And then on I-5, between the end of Boeing Field and I-90, running heavy at this time. And that's it for this traffic update. After this news break, for the second hour of Transformation Talk Radio, we have the Dr. Pat Show. And today, Mara Branscombe shares potent self-care and soul-care rituals that awaken freedom, joy, depth of spirit, and wild, untamed self-love.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. The man charged with killing several people at a parade in Highland Park, Illinois, considered a second mass shooting the same day. Lake County State's Attorney Eric Reinhardt says Robert Cremo III came upon a 4th of July celebration in Madison, Wisconsin, and was going to open fire on that event.
Indications are that he hadn't put enough thought and research into it.
Madison is just over 2 hours away from the crime scene in Highland Park. Cremo has been charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder and is being held without bond. He'll be back in court July 28th. President Biden has called the wife of WNBA star Brittany Griner about Griner's captivity in Russia. White House correspondent Mike Memoli has details.
The vice president participated in this discussion as well, as the administration has been really trying to stress that this is an all-hands-on-deck effort to try to secure Griner's release.
The statement said Biden told Sherelle Griner he's working to secure her release as soon as possible, along with other U.S. nationals who are wrongfully detained or held hostage in Russia and around the world. The man accused of being the driver behind a deadly smuggling attempt in Texas is a no-show at his court appearance. Attorneys for Homero Zamorano waived today's detention hearing. That means he'll likely stay locked up until trial. The 45-year-old is accused of transporting dozens of illegal immigrants from the Texas border to the city of San Antonio in the back of a big rig. There was no air conditioning and 53 died. Two of his co-conspirators waived their detention hearings as well. The number of job openings in the U.S. is falling. That's the conclusion from the latest job openings and labor turnover survey from May. Federal officials put the number at more than 11.2 million. ESPN Films' new documentary about legendary broadcaster Dick Vitale is set to debut later this month. Dickie V will tell the story of Vitale's life as a Hall of Fame broadcaster, ESPN's main voice of college basketball, and his battle with cancer. The documentary will air on ESPN July 23rd at 4 p.m. Eastern. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
In the wee hours of the night, when everyone else is fast asleep, you're the one on third shift, burning the midnight oil. When a part fails and everything comes to a grinding halt, regardless of what the clock on the wall says, you leap into action. Grainger is with you and all the ones who get it done. With 24/7 customer support by phone or click to chat. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And now for your alternative talk weather outlook. For today, we'll have scattered showers throughout the day under mostly cloudy skies, giving us a high near 72 and southwest winds around 6 miles per hour. Overnight, those conditions continue with a low around 59. For tomorrow, we'll see gradually clearing skies throughout the day, bringing us a high near 73 and a low around 57. And finally for Friday, partly sunny, high near 73.
No matter who we are or where we come from, we all experience difficulties in life.
Military veterans know that sometimes it takes strength and determination to make it through.
Whether it's obvious physical challenges or struggles on the inside, it takes strength to ask for help when you need it.
I knew that I had to get support, not just for me, but for the sake of my wife and kids.
Talking about it has helped me feel more like myself again.
Honestly, it was hard to open up at first, but it's changed my life for the better.
Learn how veterans like us have reached out for help and hear stories of strength and recovery at MakeTheConnection.net.
High school sports are as American as apple pie. To a game or meet is a chance to see the stars of tomorrow shine today. But as anybody who's ever attended a high school sporting event in Washington knows, you can't have the stars without the stripes. High schools are currently looking for new officials in almost every sport. Who looks good in stripes? Anybody looking for a way to stay connected to a sport they love. If you like the idea of giving back to your community while earning a few extra bucks, chances are you'd look good in stripes, too. We want to hear from you. We need to hear from you. No officials means no games. No stripes means no stars. And what kind of America would that be? Washington needs more high school officials. Go to highschoolofficials.com to sign up or learn more. That's highschoolofficials.com.
Hi, it's comedian Darren Streblo. Do you have any weird friends? All my friends are weird. But then again, they're all comedians. And not only that, they're all clean comedians. Join me and my unusual friends every Sunday morning at 7 a.m. on Alternative Talk 1150 for the nation's premier clean comedy talk show, the Darren Streblo Comedy Show. Laughter is the best medicine, and we've got your dose. Sunday mornings at 7 right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Drive Time Radio with New York Vinny.
Hi, it's New York Vinny inviting you to join me as I return to Seattle with another one of my passions, cars. An hour version of Drive Time is a weekly look at the automotive world from classics right on through to electrics. Each week we'll review the new, reminisce about the old, and talk about a lifestyle that is built around cars and the people who drive them. Saturday mornings at 8, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 KKNW.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasily and Transformation Talk Radio.
Are you passionate about impacting social change or working towards anti-racism as a society? Are you willing to deconstruct your innermost thoughts, ideas, and beliefs about racism? Then Inflection Point Podcast, Cultivating Change from the Inside Out, is the show for you. Join Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter in open, honest, and deliberate conversations every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Does your life often feel like an emotional tsunami where rogue waves crash down on you, leaving you feeling hopeless and wondering if it will ever end? Do you wish to awaken the dormant strength inside of you? Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Start today by scheduling a complimentary consultation with Martinet. Dive into your healing journey and begin to see your life in a new light. Visit martineemmons.com and make your appointment today.
ADHD tendencies get in the way of you doing what you intend to? Traditional strategies for getting things done may not work for you. You need solutions tailored for your unique brain. In Bonnie Minku's training membership program, Productivity Pathfinder, learn ADHD self-mastery step-by-step at your own pace in a supportive community with live online options each week. Learn more about Productivity Pathfinder at thrivewithadd.com.
Hi, welcome. This is Dr. John DeMartini. This is one of the most amazing and inspiring shows that you can listen into. If you want to be on the edge of your seats, if you want to open up your heart, if you want to expand your mind, and you want to meet incredible people, stay tuned because you're just about to experience a transformative radio show that will change your life. And you're listening to the Dr. Pat Show that's coming up right next.
Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. Talk radio to thrive by. Powerful, inspiring, and coming to you live, bringing you stories of people like you and me, busting through and living life full out. Get ready to dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail.
Hey, everybody, welcome. It's so great to have all of you tune us in and turn us on. We have a great show for you today. I'm Dr. Pat. I'm the host of the Dr. Pat Show. And I'm joined by a couple of my sidekicks here today, Jacob and Benny, both of my producers, making this come to you like easily, like super easily.
Hey, how's it going?
That was way better to say.
Well, you say it to both of us, Pat. Who's supposed to go first? That's so
Are you playing me back? What is all that reverb going on in there?
Fine.
Oh, my God. This is like, what is that?
That's not us, is it? Are you getting reverb? Are you serious?
I love it.
Oh.
That was so cool. It was like I said it, and then it, like, played back. And then I said, oh, my gosh, did I actually sound like this? But you know what? Because of that flower moon, that happened. I'm not kidding. It was full moon, and I think it started yesterday, and they're calling it a flower moon.
Huh.
Right? Yeah. So So none of us here in the Pacific Northwest, of course, could see it. Why? Because it's been gray for like a really long time. And I think the sun was trying to pop out, but you don't have to see it to appreciate it. You know, from an astrological perspective, they're calling it a lunar eclipse. They're calling it a flower moon. You know, they're representing the blooming of flowers, the rebirthing of life. And that's the meaning here for this. And it's really fascinating because anytime you say anything with the word Scorpio in it, people cringe. Now, certainly if that is your sign, you don't. But there's transformational life. There's an energy of this. And people are feeling it. You know, I've talked to more people, Benny, Jacob, I don't know if you guys know this, but I've talked to more people that describe this past week, not this coming week, but this past week, as quite the disturbance. And I have a friend that even looked at this so closely with the whole Mercury now coming out of retrograde, you know, ancient traditions of shamanism that point to communications, literally that can focus on the energetic shift. And so when I was talking to my friend about 4 weeks ago, she said to me, something is going to happen at a national level with communication, and you won't believe it. And I just thought, that hits every day, dude. Like, okay, that's not a prediction. That's like every day. Every day in the United States, there's something that comes on, and it's like something. She said, no, no, something. Secrets will be revealed. Now, we now know that that is true, especially when we think about what is being revealed to us. But then there's the shift of energy. And when there's a shift of energy, are we prepared for it? You know, are we in the very core of who we are? Is our soul guiding the ship? Is there something that is within each and every one of us that helps us interpret, that helps us take action? And I got to tell you, almost every one of the host week was this incredible week of stuff just piling up, piling up, piling up to be done with. Now, here's the question for our show today, and I want to introduce you to Daniel Mueller. The shamanic soul. What is it about the shamanic soul? What is it about this that we could learn? This is a guidebook, but this isn't just that. You know, this is written by practitioner of Peruvian shamanism, and Daniel teaches us shamanism through some very interesting methods, healing, spell work. But one of the things that we learn about the ancient and the modern is that there is a connection, right? It's like, why are people feeling the energy of things? Why are people looking at this flower moon, this eclipse? What is it we look for? But the question really is, are we really doing anything new? No, because when we hear from Daniel in the fantastic book that he's written, we're going to go through this. I just love, there's so many things about this I love. What is it about us, our shamanic bodies, that could be almost like this guidepost, right? What is it about what we learn and bring forward? And is my greatest fear going to come to pass, or are the Daniels of the world going to help us? Are we going to lose this knowledge? Daniel, great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to see you, Dr. Pat.
Great to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
A lot of questions. I'm not going to throw them all at you at once, but when my friend said that to me like 4 weeks ago, I think it was like in April or something, I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, look, if you go back in time and you go back into ancient messaging, but if you can connect that to your soul, you can connect that to your soul journey, then Pat, I guarantee you somewhere in May you will call me and you will say, dude, you got it right. Of course, she got to me first, and she was, what she was talking about is the whole Supreme Court leak. Mm. That. But the question I have for you is this. Look, you have done something that I've always longed to do. I didn't do it. I grew up with comic books. I wanted to create comic books. I didn't do it. You did it. Although I do have an animation comic. I do have characters that I'm drawing to educate people about Lyme disease. I want to ask you this question. There's so much I could say about you, but I have to know. How did you become you? What did you have to overcome to become you, to become the author of great books, bringing this message forward, getting Llewellyn to actually put pictures in the book? What did you have to get beyond, Daniel?
Oh, thank you for that. I had to get through a lot personally. And so my book, Shamanic Soul, details some of that journey and some of the adversity that I had to overcome in order to kind of finally fit into my own shoes, to finally really become me and who I appreciate being. as myself. And a lot of that really wasn't external adversity, although we oftentimes project it as that. But it was really just all internal stuff. You know, those regressions within the subconscious that kind of keep us and prevent us from moving forward and taking opportunities in life that are abundantly there. The universe is like open and wide, and there are so many different choices and pathways that we can take, and not every one of them are ideal. And sometimes the path that it takes to get you to where you want to go may not be ideal, but the more you can kind of, you know, step aside from your fears, your insecurities, those aspects of yourself that, you know, will prevent you from being able to make movement, will prevent you from being able to transform and move beyond your current state. You know, it'll keep you there. So that's really essentially what I had to overcome, which is no easy feat, as a lot of people will attest in their own lives. And I mean, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was pretty severe. It impacted actually my physical health. It had me in the hospital multiple times, and I was, you know, for a good decade or more.
Yeah. You and I have a lot of things in common, right?
Obviously, yes, we do.
We really do. It's crazy, but the reason I do this, I love this. I can't remember where in your book you say this, and for those of you just tuning in, I think Jacob's going to show you copies of the book, The Shamanic Soul. Something's happening to me, right? You would think that at this point in time in my life, like, I'd be done, right? But when I get the honor of interviewing somebody like you, Daniel, and get to honor your work and your journey, and especially since my latest discovery, I still can't even make sense of this, to be honest with you. My grandfather being born in Brazil, the greatest secret of all time, but then the internet, so you can't hide from your relatives anymore because, like, they have your name, right? There's something that shifts in us. But the shamanic soul, I mean, honestly, when just saying it, the vibration, shamanic soul, is powerful. I am so afraid we're going to lose these teachings. How important is it for you to pass the baton and keep this going? And what is your experience, if you could, with the shamanic soul?
Well, in terms of the importance of these teachings, it's absolutely vital. The minute that I entered my training with my maestro, I understood the importance of carrying this lineage forward that has been alive for thousands of years. And it's not really about my specific lineage. It's about all teachings of all of the earth-honoring traditions across the planet, which is it's not necessarily about replicating the ceremonies of the past, more so than honoring and recognizing, you know, what the past is trying to help us remember, which is, for me, what that shamanic soul is our direct connection with Pachamama, with Mother Earth, and not just her, but the soul of her. We are expressions of that world soul, that animus mundi, as the Greeks call it. We are vital, creative components of this planet that are here to have relationship with her. And when we do, we can tap into our own sort of soul walk, as I like to call it, our soul pathway, our ability to find our flow, I think is how I refer to it in the book, of what you're kind of here to do as an expression of the world soul, as an expression of Pachamama herself. So I always like to remind people this isn't just a spiritual thing either. You know, biologically, like, you know, particle wise, we came out of the mother. We are literally physically her children, and to like honor that and recognize that. And for me, soul is like less of an esoteric spiritual concept and more of just What I like to relate it to is jazz or art. It's the ability for that human to tap into that connection and then just letting that energy flow, whether it's through dance, music, what you're doing here, Dr. Pat, you know, having conversations and us just reminding each other that we're all connected and we're all connected to this one organism. And she's our mama, and let's start gearing things in a more positive direction, and have less division and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I love this. I love this conversation. That's why I had to get the backdrop for people to really understand, Daniel, from your perspective and the way you've written the book. I'm a kid from the Bronx, New York, but somehow my grandfather, and I didn't know this when I was younger, my grandfather was a farmer in Brazil, greatest secret on the planet, to really hide that heritage. To have an entire family keep a secret that grandpa and papa's mama were born in Brazil in farming, and then change the name, and then change his ethnicity, change, like, he went from Brazilian to Italian, and he changed the letter at the end of the, it was just crazy. But when he came over, see, this is what I remember. This is really to your point. I got to spend time with Papa in the Bronx on a lot where he had used tires, and he had a shack. And in the shack, I could tell you the smell of the kerosene and the oil painting. And as you went out the back of the shack, rows and rows and rows, vegetables and herbs, and you could smell them. And what I love about this is, and I don't know if this is factual, so can you fact check me? I don't know of a culture in our origins that didn't start out with an absolute absorption to Pachamama, to absolute absorption to the earth. Now, Greta Thunberg is trying to help us remember, but why is it we forget that that is where we started, Daniel?
Yeah, I don't think that there is a culture, at least a spiritual tradition within the various civilizations across the planet that didn't have a shamanic root, that didn't have at its core basically a shamanic-like figure that had interaction with the unseen realms and came back to bring medicine to the people. It was what came after when people started institutionalizing that and whatnot. And I think that's where we are kind of forgetting. So if you're familiar with Douglas Adams and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and whatnot, we have a Vogon mentality in our lives. And it's not that it's necessarily evil, but it can get there. But we have the ability to take this wonderful thing, like direct revelation from some spiritual experience,
mm-hmm.
and we try to begin to categorize it and to, distribute it through forms and through protocol mm-hmm. and creeds and whatnot, and it becomes an established religion or a doctrine or even a book, right? You know, even a book, there can be some danger, and which is why in my book, I try to undo a lot of what I created at the end to make room for the reader to just know and understand that, you know, it's not about having a teaching and a direct teaching and carrying it verbatim forward. It's about taking medicine from one generation to another and then passing it on to the next so mm-hmm. that they can kind of do it in their own way,
mm-hmm.
which is vitally important for the evolution and growth of the planet. You don't want stagnation by having a particular tradition just mm-hmm. acting the same way each, you don't grow and evolve and adapt, and you don't want that. So I do think that the act of forgetting, which is, you know, there's a lot of myths across various cultures about, you know, when a being, and I think the Greeks have, like, whenever you drink from the river of forgetfulness, whenever you come into incarnation. And so the way I was taught in my shamanic training, it's kind of like a game. It's not a bad thing we forget, because if we always remembered all the time that direct connection,
mm-hmm.
what fun would that be? the fun is trying to remember and trying to have that journey of reconnection again. And so when we talk a lot about evolutionary potential and in these transformational communities, it's always important to remember that, you know, if we ever got to an end state of like, you know, perfect alignment with source or creation, you know, what my teacher taught me is if you got there, you would just want to go back to the beginning and be ignorant of everything again anyway, because it's the total
zodiac. It's the total astrology chart. It's the total, well, when you get to the 12th house, you're not like done. You don't like die.
Right.
Right? It's the evolution. But, you know, here's what I love about this is, and I want to talk to you about this, you know, right out of the gate. There are many books that I've read in 20 years. And what I really find refreshing now is when I find a book like this one where you take us at a very, anybody can learn this right from the beginning, the training part. And I looked at that training diagram you had and I thought, oh, 20 years of doing this, I had no idea that there was this dynamic in operation. But what I love about it is you're able to introduce this to us in so many ways. I especially loved, you know, the part, I think I'm stuck on trials and I think I have a little challenge thing today. But I love that you, you say here under the train, the hero faces a variety of challenges to prepare for the supreme ordeal, the final battle with the dragon, as it were. Trials along the way will test your metal, that's like not metal, and therefore increase your stamina. Overcoming these challenges will make you stronger and prepare you to face the future. You see, I have heard that message from my mom and my stepmom, and she was the queen of that, but not in this context. Can you talk to the supreme ordeal, please? It's almost like I'm watching the movie Eternals, right, where they got like the supreme being, but now we're taking it down to our life, our journey.
So I'm paraphrasing and utilizing Joseph Campbell's monomyth paradigm, you know, as a kind of a relational connection to shamanic training in general and really just life in general. And that's what Joseph Campbell was trying to do, is show through all of these myths and spiritual traditions throughout the planet how they all kind of have the same pattern to them, and they're all really about having that message to us in life, and that which is a cycle about going in and facing these travails, these tribulations, and learning from that, and then returning back to community with that gained wisdom. And so the supreme ordeal isn't necessarily like a person who has to go and climb a mountain and fight a dragon, or you have to go and face the corporate, you know, paradigm that you're trying to battle in your own personal, whatever it is. And maybe that is.
I did that already. I did that one.
Well, I did that
in 1992. So, okay, can I check that off my list?
There you go. Then you're good. You're done. So, but the supreme ordeal is really just that always, because it's a cycle. Once you're done, you're starting over again. It's always that primary roadblock that is going to be in place for you, that's going to prevent you from keeping forward on that soul path of yours, and that continued growth and evolution to make you a better you. So it can be anything. It can be your own internal thing. It could be a conditional situation in your life. So Dr. Jose Stevens relates that to your dragon. You know, there are many dragons that we face in our lives, and he's a transpersonal psychologist. I believe that might be his preferred title, where that's how he kind of describes what the supreme ordeal is, too. And he's hearkening on myths as well, right? Yeah. And you're right to mention Eternals because, I mean, we're surrounded by, you know, all of these types of mythologies, the superhero mythology, even sports, whatever, where we're constantly facing that next, you know, tournament, that next struggle, that next thing to get us to a better level, you know. And athletes are a great thing to look to this. athletes don't play. You know, they don't just kind of tentatively show up, you know, and, you know, they're just like, well, I didn't put much effort to it. They train all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They're always working towards that goal, and they have to get in almost a meditative state of mind in order to be in the zone whenever they're actually in the zone.
Mm.
And so that the athlete is actually a great paradigm to study for people that are really interested in spiritual growth or psychological growth or whatever it is that you're trying to do in your life, because they are the perfect embodiment of discipline and hard work, of practice, 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 and focus. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so we're going to take a short break, but I want to just let everybody know a couple of things. Daniel, first of all, tell people the Shamanic Soul, and it is a guidebook for self-exploration, healing, and mysticism. And when we come back from break, we're going to really take it to part two about this. But this is not the only book. You have a number of other books that you've done. Love the comic book thing, the whole thing. I've got like comic book envy. But how do people find out about you, and how did they get a copy of your book? Please tell folks.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can find me at my website, danielmullerweb.com, but you can find the Shamanic Soul at any book distributor, but we always prefer to point people back to the publisher, llewellen.com, and you pre-order directly from them. It's available for pre-order now, and it comes out June 8th.
Yeah, and again, that's Llewellyn. And for those of you out there, make sure. And I think, Jacob, you know, once you put the book up, you could also direct them to Llewellyn's website if you could. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, there's so much that I've pulled out of the book. By the way, I read the book, so that's why I'm referencing the book.
I appreciate it.
But we have a current theme that we're launching this year. Fascinating to me for our crowdfunding and our expansion. And when I used the term, some people cringed. But then I saw it in the book, and I thought, I'm not changing it. He's right. He's got this nailed down. What is the phrase that Daniel uses in the book when he is like even talking about the shamanic body? What is he saying? And why is the language so strong? Let's take a short break. Benny, Jacob, we'll be right back, everybody.
Brilliance already lives inside of you. Come discover it so you can shine brightly in this world. Join me, your host, Adrienne Cobb, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, during Wild Magic on TransformationTalkRadio.com, and get answers to who you are and where you belong. To learn more about me and the show, visit MyWildMagic.com. Again, that's MyWildMagic.com.
Are you having difficulty feeling at home in your own home? Join Annette Rigolo and Dr. Pat in Enlightened Environments, Optimizing from the Outside In, as they present a deep dive into the various vibrations of the Earth, along with man-made energies that impact our lives. Using the Diamond Dowsing Method, we will utilize specific vibrations to elevate our own homes to support us and expand us with their energy. Join us every third Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time to make your home, home.
Do you get stuck in that someday attitude, living the same day over and over again with no action? The Becoming You Show, big ideas that inspire, impact, and influence your life with Leah Rowling, is for you. Tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. Central on TransformationTalkRadio.com. This show will have you feeling inspired to take action with purpose and intention. For more information and to get in touch with me, visit www.leahrowling.com.
What could you achieve if you knew someone was going to ask about your progress every week? Accountability matters. Small corrections and check-ins with your goals can lead to big results in your business without you feeling overwhelmed. Success Magnified owner Mary Gall provides entrepreneurs a system of goal setting and accountability to create clarity about where you are now, your future direction, and the most effective way to get there. Book your free call at successmagnified.com today.
You are made for more. I'm Coach Lisa, and I'm here to help you achieve ultimate life satisfaction. Your life matters to the world. Reimagine your future with an individualized life by design approach with my free ebook, The 5 C's of Coaching: Commitment, Clarity, Coachable, Creative, and Change. Find the transformation you're looking for. Go to lisabelz.com. That's LYSABELTZ.com.
Day-to-day living can be difficult in our world today. Most of us don't know how to live a peaceful, joy-filled existence. Learn how to break through these barriers and live a transformative life on Love and Light with me, Dr. Lisa. Every day living in peace, every second and fourth Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To work with Dr. Lisa, visit EducationThroughEngagement.com.
I don't even know. I'm going to have Daniel come back to talk about some of these other things, especially the psychonaut. But today we're talking about the shamanic soul. Daniel, before we continue, one more time, please direct people. And then Jacob, maybe you can put something up on the video part to get people over to Llewellyn. How do they get the book? But also, there's so many other things you're involved in. How do they find that out about you?
Yep, find me at danielmullerweb.com. You can find me there and all my fun stuff and links to my social media profiles. And then Llewellyn.com, you can get pre-order my book. It'll be out June 8th.
By the way, it's like the funnest thing. So if you go over to a site, I want you all to go over and just click on the sessions button just for the heck of it. This is so very cool, right? To take a look at the diversity, but also the imagination, and that imagination that comes from, you know, our unlimited possibilities to dream. And dreaming, by the way, was such a part. Look, before the break, I referenced a phrase in your book, and it's a phrase that I've actually gotten a little bit of feedback, but I'm staying true to myself. I actually have a show that's called Power Up with Dr. Pat. But I had to do a double take back in the book, because right here in the shamanic body, you say taking the power back. And I thought, oh, my gosh, is that why we feel lost? Is that why we feel like we're disconnected? Is that why? Tell me about that, and tell me about how this one part of the book sets the stage for everything else to come.
Yeah.
Almost everything, maybe.
Yeah. A very prominent curandero from the lineage I was trained in a few generations back, Don Eduardo Calderon from Peru, said that the main pivot of shamanism is about power and one's own personal power. And if you've read some, you know, different accounts from indigenous, you know, individuals that are, you know, working in that shamanic context, it's all about that, about having the necessary power to do the work necessary. And I really kind of relate that to a personal context of one's own power. And I kind of in the book walk through a few necessary items that individuals, you know, really should have as a core foundation before continuing forward, which is, you know, ensuring that, you know, you honor and recognize all knowledge, individuality, being able to be variable with life and not just be tied down to one specific thought form or way of living, focus, balanced. You know, these are just some of the main pillars that one needs into this house of power, really, that you need to have as the kind of framework before moving forward. Because if you don't have this, if you don't have that personal power, you know, everything will shatter. And your whatever change you're trying to implement won't hold and won't stay. So you have to be clear. You have to be focused and balanced and have certain aspects of your life together and be ready to hold and contain that. And a lot of people are afraid of that. A lot of people are afraid of having their own personal power, and we don't realize whether it's from a familial context or a societal context. I mean, just even look at social media, whatever. We give our power away all the time. We give our information away. We give, our self-esteem away to every ad that comes our way on the TV or on Facebook or whatever. We give it all. It's like a continual reminder of replenishing oneself and making sure that you know that for yourself, I mean, you're not the center of the universe because the universe is bigger than that. But for you and your perspective, you are the center. And it's okay to treat yourself and honor yourself in that way and give yourself a foundation to stand on, because you wouldn't have the context of understanding reality and interact reality without the strong core mm-hmm. that exists here within oneself.
I love this for so many ways, and I would love for you to talk about this, because even when you're talking, when you're going through the process, you're talking about, you talk about return to power. Thank you for using that word. I want to really talk to you about a couple of other things. You know, everything that we know seems to be, I don't know how to say this better, but we are now in a pop culture, and I don't even want to call it that, but let's just say we're in a modern culture that is just so revering so many of the energies that you address here. And what am I talking about? Everything from Doctor Strange and the multiverse madness, right, and some of the things that come forth there, to now going back and honoring and respecting the elders, right? You see, most of the cultures that I think you and I are familiar with, when you're looking at the elder body, they are it. They're going to tell you whether you're going to plant that potato or you're not going to plant the potato, right? Right. But when you take us on the journey in the book, really struck by getting to the place of the cosmos and consciousness, sometimes we feel like we're not on a parallel trajectory, a harmonious trajectory. Somehow we feel like we're on this dynamic, the moon is going to hit the earth trajectory. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to talk about this a minute, because the cosmos and the consciousness, they seem like they're separate. But are they?
No, that's part of the illusion that mm-hmm. we have, and that forgetfulness that you and I were talking about earlier. And we do have this interesting way in society of kind of constructing civilization around us as a way to denote a sort of separation that exists. And so in my shamanic training, some of the first ordeals that I was put through was about breaking that down. So you don't see that differentiation. So you understand that in terms of the cosmos, you are the fount of creation. Creation doesn't just happen as this separate mechanism, or even, it just only happens out in nature, in the woods, or out in the stars. This is it. Like what we're doing right now, you and I, with the electronics, everything, like this is the fount of creation. This is the forefront of it right here. And that's kind of essential to actually understanding the power dynamics that are at play within shamanic healing, shamanic ritual, and ceremony. So having not just an understanding of that or an intellectual understanding, shamanic training tries to put you through ordeals so that you have that as a felt experience. You live it and you breathe it, and it's not a circumstance that's under question, really, because you're experiencing every moment.
Yeah. One of the things that I love talking about, and you bring us on this journey in the book, Daniel, we go through this. But I am so glad that you kind of kicked it out by talking about magic. Hello, right? There's never been, somebody asked me what I thought the greatest comeback of our century has been. People ask me the oddest questions, and it depends on the day. But I remember this was a couple of years ago, and I said, oh, by far, that's easy. Comeback of the century is magic. And they looked at me and they said, what are you talking about? And this was at the Harry Potter time, right?
Yep.
And I said, think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, think about something that was so, like, not okay, now just being revered in such an interesting way. But magic and magic and just that word, all of this is on a path to healing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think we'd be alive as a humans if people did not have these practices. I mean, what would they have done? They couldn't have gone to the pharmacy.
Right.
What is your thought?
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to understand what magic is. My publisher made me expand that chapter a little bit because my original plan was just to have one page just saying, you know what magic is. Move on.
Yeah, no.
Like, everybody should know what magic is. If you were a child, you knew what magic was. Everybody's experienced Christmas. Everybody's experienced, and it's not just like this feeling, though. Magic is the ability to change reality in accordance with one's will. And so that can come in a variety of ways, but it's just as magic is just as simple as watching a movie or reading a book. Your reality gets changed. You know, you come out of a movie going, whoa, that blew my mind. That's magic. If you can't read a book and your mind was changed about something, you've seen reality in a whole new way. So I'm not trying to demean magic in any way, shape, or form, because I've seen and experienced some crazy stuff that you would only probably see in Doctor Strange or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So that exists. But we also have to understand that magic just happens at so many levels, and a recognition of the variability of how magic manifests in our daily lives is very important and essential, because oftentimes it will really just only manifest as that. And if we just recognize that, we see magic everywhere. Every day becomes Christmas in that regard. So yeah, it's very important for healing, because you have to change. It's like alchemy. It's transmuting lead into gold. It's transmuting this, you know, very dense, sick person, plagued with mind stuff or physical stuff, and transmuting that into something that can grow and evolve out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, all of the ceremonies that I were involved in, they were all magic based, to get me to the place where I am today.
So there's a chapter in the book, right, that I've never heard anybody talk about this. And, you know, because I'm a little bit learning different, I have a little difficulty sometimes with words. So when I first looked at it and looked at shamanic report, which that's not what it is.
Yep.
I thought, whoa. Wait a minute. This was so fascinating to see this in the book. And I wanted to take a minute for you to talk about it, because you use language here, bringing it all together, right? There's something about this particular part of your writing and part of the book that is usually not included.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about this? Because it's almost like you're creating a tapestry, but this is kind of the thread. Talk to it, and it's not report.
Yeah, shamanic rapport.
Rapport.
Yeah, and you're right. I've read some other books, and I don't ever see this aspect brought up a lot. I have in some cases, but this was actually one of the core tenets of my training. And if you didn't have this as a vital component from the beginning, with every ceremony, with every exercise, then you're lost. And it's about understanding, you know, a lot of this manifests as giving offerings to the spirits, giving offerings to the land, giving, you know, and it's more about giving offerings like, okay, let's, you know, give up our harvest and blah, da, 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 da. It's about creating a gift of communication to the invisible architects that exist around us all the time, so that we can exist in co- cooperation with them. So we can exist in a participatory experience rather than us just taking from the environment and taking energy from, you know, whatever. So I relate this to, I always relate this back to just having a relationship with my wife, right? If I'm in a relationship with my wife, I don't just take from her from what I want and treat her as I want and only just, you know, get what I need in order to make myself, you know, happier. I have to give back. I have to give her love back. I have to give her flowers. I have to give her foot massages, you know, all the things that she needs. And just so being a shamanic practitioner is about having a relationship with the spirits of the natural world. And we have to have that same kind of relationship. It's not about them being necessarily better than us or us being better than them. It's about having this like mode of communication. And so, you know, various shamanic lineages across the planet, and I would definitely point out the Quechua peoples of Peru have a very sophisticated system of offerings that are very much in alignment with the spirits of the land around them. The spirits understand the types of offerings that are given in the way that they're given. And it's not just about, hey, throwing some tobacco on the ground or burning some sage.
No.
It's about making a whole pristine ritual surrounding that in the same way that you would write a letter or a card to your loved one. Petitioning and asking for what you're asking for assistance with and showing the expression of love in that as well. So when we do ceremony locally in our community and my wife and I, great time and care is given to that aspect of the offering of the haiwa, as we call it, the gift back to Pachamama and the spirits around us. Because it's you wouldn't want to be frivolous with giving a gift to someone you love, you know, and especially if you're asking for something really important and asking for that assistance. So I don't know if that's the thread you were necessarily
asking. Yeah, it's absolutely. There's no question about it, because the reason I wanted to ask you about it, because, you know, as we move forward and we really bring this full circle, we're talking about the shamanic soul, shamanic healing. And one of the things we have to remember is that that everything in life is an exchange. See, we don't really get that. You know, I happened to study exchange theory in school because I needed to understand it for my own personal being. But everything is an exchange, right? You know, we take air in, we bring air out. But you're so right. The first time, my introduction into giving back came in a strange way, even before my first vision quest. And it had to do on the island of Hawaii. And it had to do with something I did that I didn't understand. And then I was schooled in the ritual from Madame Pele, you know, a bottle of gin. I mean, honestly, I was literally, and what I learned about that, and when I learned about the care that you're discussing and talking about, it's hard to describe the energy that passes through you.
Yep. Yeah, there's definitely, we have what we designate as wakas that exist throughout the planet, which are various sacred sites that have a certain type of energy around them.
Yeah.
And they respond to different things in different ways. It's their language, right, for understanding. So in Peru, we can create a haiwa called a despacho, which is a very specific type of offering that the mountain spirits there understand.
Yep.
There are certain areas here in North America, and we've tried it before, creating that same type of despacho, and they're like, uh-uh.
No.
No. And sometimes we'll even outright reject it and show ways of rejecting it right then and there. You have to learn what the spirits of that area that you live on, what they understand and what they can assimilate as information to them. And it's like, and you mentioned Jen, and I was reminded of when I went and did offerings to the grave of Marie Laveau in New Orleans, you know, cigars and, whiskey, and it's like it's a completely different experience.
Yeah.
But when you give it in that way, the type of energy that comes in is way different. It's like a key fitting into the right lock.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that energy opens, and it's very interesting.
It's fascinating. And, you know, part of this brings us to understanding that this is all in service of something so powerful. And I think that, you know, what you bring us to in the book is healing. And I love that we use that word. I mean, not just individually, but of course, yes. But there are many, many, many energies that can be healed. And I love that you pointed that out, because my vision questing in the high desert of California in the Sierras, very different ritual, you know, very different. Like you're down to 3 tablespoons of water.
Yep.
And you... and you're thinking, this is something I'm not going to give you. And you're like, dearly mistaken about that. Mm. But you're right. Let's have a conversation about taking our healing power back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Healing in some regards can, you know, is a word that people don't, you know, they will just look at it from a medical context or...
Yeah.
And I don't want to eliminate that either, because I actually had medical healing, but it's really, I always just see it as a word, it's another word for evolution, for change, but it's very specifically tied to a state of misalignment that is getting aligned, getting yourself back into balance, getting yourself back into focus. So kind of turning something that's from a negative into a positive, knowing that there's going to be another inverse, another negative that you're going to have to turn, because it's a cycle again.